Killer Innovations Podcast for Sunday, July 17th, 2005, show number 19, brought to you from Washington, D.C. Hello, this is Phil McKinney, and welcome to this week's podcast. Before we get started, please keep in mind that the opinions and information expressed in this podcast are mine and mine alone and do not necessarily reflect those of my past, current, or future employers. Earlier this week, I was in Manchester, New Hampshire. I was giving a keynote speech to the CIOs from higher education. So this included the CIOs from universities such as Purdue, University of Illinois, Stanford, University of Alaska, about 150, 200 of the CIOs. It's kind of an interesting group of CIOs to get in front of from the standpoint of some of the unique challenges facing higher education. And obviously one of the big topics was is how do private industry and higher education work better together with regards to research and development. So that was earlier this week. I'm back in Washington, D.C. Thanks for all the comments that have been coming in. I do appreciate that. I am catching up on the emails. To help facilitate a broader community and in support of today's topic on this podcast, which is innovation collaboration, we decided to go ahead and launch the beta version of the Killer Innovation Community site. So go to the killerinnovations.com website and read the blog post for yesterday, July 16th, for details, and there's a link. The link is a really long link because it is still a test link. It's on a test server. But given today's topic and just the significant increase in listenership and emails, we thought we'd go ahead and launch the beta version of the community site. So this is a site where you'll see areas such as open innovation. So this is hopefully a virtual site that people can either post requests for ideas or help put together virtual diverse teams to brainstorm around a particular problem or particular idea. There's also one on structured innovation. You'll recognize that link because that's where I posted up the Visio version of the Gate Milestone Map. But there's I've actually been going ahead and I posted up there the metrics that we've talked about in the last couple of podcasts with some additional information to kind of trigger that. And there's a whole bunch of other sites, and there's actually one of the segments of the community site also is for you to provide feedback and comments. In that section, I've posted up the details about the ID3 tags that we are now using in the MP3 file so that you'll have all the details in the event that you want to catalog, store, sort the whole set of Killer Innovation Podcast. With regards to the ID3 tags, we are still in the test mode with that, albeit we are not making any changes for this week, so this should look the same as last week's. Assuming that everything wraps up on the testing, then sometime between now and early August, we will go back and retro all of the previous podcasts with the new ID3 tags so that you can have an entire set from the beginning to now with identical tags that allow you to sort and find the podcast of interest much easier. Okay? So again, please continue to send in your feedback, questions, suggested topics for future shows. You can contact me at podcast@killerinnovations.com. You can also dial the feedback line at 1-703-636-4460. Again, that's 703-636-4460. Or you can contact me on Skype by calling, by using my Skype handle at Phil_McKinney. And with that, let's go ahead and jump right into segment one. We're going to talk about innovation collaboration. This is somewhat tied to the material that I presented in New Hampshire earlier in the week with regards to private industry and higher education linking up to work better together from the standpoint of improving the R&D capabilities within a given country. So we're going to talk a little bit about, what drives collaboration, why do people collaborate from the standpoint of innovation, and what are some of the criterias or areas that you just need to be watching out for when you're thinking about either reaching outside of your organization for collaboration around innovation, or if you're the one being seeked out from the standpoint of contributing to a collaboration. So first off, why collaborate? What drives the motivation for collaboration? Well, one is that entities, whether that be universities, governments, private industry, nonprofits, whatever the case might be, recognize that they may not be able to do it all within their own walls. In fact, it's extremely rare that you're going to have all the right capabilities from the standpoint of diversity of people, etc., to be able to generate the ideas completely yourself. So first off, you're looking for that outside source of ideas, connecting with strategic leaders, and being able to do that on a worldwide basis. We have to recognize that we all operate in a world economy, and looking and participating just with strategic leaders within your own geographic boundaries significantly hampers your perspective. Two, you also are looking to leverage the efforts and resources of others. Particularly if you're a small company, your ability to tap into much larger organizations that have much more significant funding and may be funding research and development in the specific areas that you're looking for. The other is that you want to be able to, or you'll have a high level of success of, creating the future if you collaborate and work with parties that have like-minded interests. And then also, you want to be able to drive an agenda with social impact. This is one of the key things or key interests for myself in innovation is by building up a much broader base of collaboration, not just working with one other organization, but working with an entire group of companies or like-minded individuals, then you can come around and build that consensus and build that collaboration to drive, some form of agenda that'll have impact, whether that's nationally or internationally. And then lastly, you also are looking for those ideas that are beyond the horizon. So how do you understand the issues and opportunities as they evolve and appear? You need to search out those experts who are looking beyond the horizon that can provide you that kind of source. So what's the criteria for collaboration? So you understand kind of what the motivation is, or at least the motivation that I use when I'm in discussions with companies that want to collaborate around innovation. But what's the criteria? Well, from my perspective, I'm looking at collaborations from the standpoint of strategic priorities. Is there a need to connect with external, for instance, research and development? The availability of researchers, do I have that expertise in-house or do I need to go outside? Funding, is the collaboration going to require money out of my budget, or is it some other kinds of sharing of resources that are going to allow the collaboration to occur? The intellectual property needs. Is this a collaboration where I'm looking to derive IP ownership, or am I collaborating in order to drive and contribute IP to the industry or society? And then do I have existing relationships? Can I tap existing relationships, or do I need to go find something new because the existing relationships just are not there? And then also the obvious business perspective. As I like to remind people, you for a for-profit business, you are either a business or a charity. And so ultimately it always comes down to the business perspective and the business priorities. So that's kind of the criteria that is used, at least from my perspective and my organization, as to identifying the need for collaboration. But ultimately it comes down to solving two key challenges that we all face today. One is the innovation gap. The innovation gap is the shortfall between the rising need for ideas and innovations and their inadequate supply. The continual acceleration, particularly in my space and high technology, this constant need for new, better, faster, cheaper, breakthrough acceleration is causing an immense amount of pressure in order to fill that innovation gap and their innovation need. The other is the innovation delay. Okay, so you identify the opportunity, you have to work it through your process, but there is this delay between the time when the innovation is ready for deployment and its eventual impact on the organization or society. It's just this whole rollout, the launch process. That goes back to the innovation gate milestone map process that we talked about, was it 3 or 4 podcasts ago, I guess it was, and the need really to try to drive or increase the ability to, or I should say, shorten the time that you have the idea and innovation to the time that's in the market and having its necessary impact. So, looking at the innovation gap, the innovation delay, the question is how do you collaborate, or what are some of the thinking behind putting together the collaboration? Well, I mean, it comes down to really answering, what I refer to as two fundamental questions. One is what I would call the allocation question. This is a kind of the classical question in the capitalistic society. How can we get optimal allocation of resources in a market economy? Well, it's really driven by competition. Those that win or are successful in a competitive market secure more of the revenue and the profit margins, and so therefore they get a larger allocation of the resources to invest. If you can win in the competitive market, you can therefore secure more resources to do more things. And I refer to this as kind of the invisible hand of the market. Everybody's out there slugging it out in the marketplace. And it's this invisible hand of the capitalist market that determines who is going to get the appropriate set of resources based on you being able to win or, in fact, lose in a competitive market. The other is what I would call the innovation question, which is completely different. The question is how can the economy bring forward innovation in a market economy? So it isn't just allocation of resources, but how do you bring forward innovations? And my argument is that the days of people being able to do that 100% on their own is quickly slipping away. You need multiple players. And in this case, you need to do this through what I would call organized markets or organized collaborations and long-term relationships. And rather than being the invisible hand, to answer this question, it's really driven by what I would call the visible handshake. Rather than just letting the market dynamics determine who wins or loses, being able to collaborate in such a way that you significantly improve your chance of winning in the marketplace, and doing that upfront consciously, and doing that through long-term relationships, what I would call the visible handshakes within the organization. So, what are some of the things that drive, or I should say, are the underlying characteristics for next-generation collaboration? Well, one area that you need to understand or at least be conscious of is this challenge of what I would call strong ties versus weak ties. And this is, just to kind of describe the dynamics of the types of collaboration. Strong ties would be things like families, relatives, close personal friends, college roommates, etc. Weak ties would be casual acquaintances, maybe professional associations. Now, strong ties and weak ties on collaborations have are not all either good or bad. You need a mix of strong ties and weak ties in order to be successful. So within the weak ties, you'll find that ideas are spread more slowly, and scientific endeavors in some cases may be handicapped because of the political influence. So, for instance, strong ties within a university campus or strong ties with your coworkers on your team, the tighter those ties become, the less dynamic or the less out of the box approach to the ideas emerge. Weak ties, where you have these acquaintances, you go to professional conferences and that, albeit you don't have the relationship, but you find that diversity of conversation to be very, very dynamic from the standpoint of source of ideas and source of innovations and sources of collaborations. And so you need this mix of strong ties and weak ties. You can't have just weak ties, meaning you're the one person, you don't have any relationships, and everything is weak. At the same time, you can't also be insular just within your organization. So it's really through collaboration that you already have the strong ties within your organization. It's through collaboration that you potentially create other strong ties outside, or potentially even create weak ties to look for those dynamic sources of ideas or sources of creativity. Then comes the whole issue of what I would call vertical versus horizontal networks. In the case of vertical networks, this is kind of the typical hierarchical approach, linking unequal participants in the value chain. And they're really asymmetrical relationships of hierarchy and dependencies. Very hard to establish trust. It's kind of the typical vendor supplier kind of a role. So if I need a source of idea, I go contract with a consulting company there. I treat them as a vendor, and you get this kind of very tight vertical kind of vertical network. Horizontal network is where you link agents who are treated as equal status and power. Everybody's on the same level. It is a true peer collaboration, and basically allows you to really establish trust and cooperation over a long-term basis. And what you find is the horizontal network really starts to build that trust. What I would refer to as social capital. And what I have found between the winners and losers from the standpoint of collaboration is the total amount of social capital that is created. And how do you build social capital? Well, one is you have to have a shared vision. You have to work with others to create the shared vision, common purpose. It doesn't do you any good to go off and try to create a collaboration with somebody who's, completely anti what you're trying to achieve. But at the same time, you also don't want to create somebody who's absolutely a yes person and in 100% agreement. You're looking for some friction. What you really want is what's the purpose, and create that shared vision. Secondly, is you have to build the trust. Now, this is the part that is the hardest. You have to spend time with the individuals, with the groups. You got to create a foundation of trust, and this trust is built around the shared vision. And the key here is that trust comes from the fact that your contribution, your expertise, your opinions will be valued, and so therefore, it comes down to actions and words. It's not just words, putting up a PowerPoint saying or negotiating a contract, we're going to collaborate. This is the human portion of collaboration, and you have to build the trust. You have to spend time. You have to prove to the other individuals, because they may have been unsuccessful in previous collaborations and therefore are somewhat anti to the whole idea of collaboration. It's building this trust. And once you have a shared vision and building trust, then you're at the point of talking about how do you share the resources? How do you exchange valuable resources such as people, expertise, contacts, reputations to achieve the common goal? And this is not something that you can do in a single fell swoop and be successful. You can start building collaborations on smaller activity, smaller visions, smaller common purpose programs. You have to prove it out. Building trust takes time. It's not something you can contract. It's not something you can decree from on high. This requires everybody getting their hands dirty, spending time, building those personal relationships. And only then, once you have the shared vision and build the trust, can we then really begin talking about sharing the resources. And this really lays the whole foundation for the whole open source concept. What's the shared vision, the building of trust, And then the ability to share resources, my time, other people's times, to do open source activities such as Linux or whatever the case might be. And in fact, in an upcoming podcast, I'm going to talk about what I'm going to put forward as kind of a manifesto around open innovation and how at least my thoughts around the whole concept around open innovation, and look for your feedback around around that. So that'll be in an upcoming podcast. With that, we're going to move on to segment two, weak signals. In a previous podcast, I mentioned my use of magazines as a source of weak signals, such as I shared with you Graphomatosmo, which is a magazine out of London, which highlights graffiti artists going from being purely defacing buildings or trains or buses to now going mainstream. And I received a number of emails asking about other magazines that I read, things that I found of interest. So what I'm going to do is I've got a stack of magazines sitting here on my desk. This is just a typical 1 month read, not even a 1 month read. It's probably half of a 1 month read. And I'm just going to walk through, I'm going to look at the cover and just kind of describe to you why I read certain publications. And I'll put the entire list up on the Killer Innovations podcast site, so you don't have to worry about trying to remember this or write this down. But you can at least get a feel for what I read, and how what I do from the standpoint of using magazines as a source. One of the reasons I like magazines is because I spend so much time on airplanes. I find being able to take, a dozen magazines, stuff them into my magazine. I actually have a special briefcase that's just called my read bag with my books and magazines that I'm currently reading. So I carry two carry-ons on my long flights, and probably two-thirds of the read bag is just magazines. So let's go ahead and just walk through this, and let me know if you find this useful. Again, let me just walk through the list. So first off, ID Magazine. This is the industrial design magazine. This is absolutely one of my must-read magazines every month. My background really is I was originally in college as an architecture major before realizing that I can make a lot more money in the computer science space. But my background is computer graphics animation. So I come from a my kind of thinking style is extremely visual. My entire office in my house is covered with whiteboards and et cetera. So I'm a very visual kind of an individual. But I find the ID magazine, the industrial design magazine, to be kind of a key source, at least for current trends and directions of design, et cetera. Next, Dynamic Graphics. Now, a lot of people would think this is kind of a rinky-dink magazine for, the small and medium-sized business on the design. But again, it gives you kind of a look at what are some of the emerging kind of design elements that are coming up. How Magazine. So this is the magazine basically aimed at a lot of the Photoshop people, that type of thing. But again, I use these magazines on the graphics and design side to really be a source for me for what are some of the new emerging trends that are occurring in that space. A magazine that comes out of London called Monitor Unlimited. Monitor Unlimited covers everything from architecture, furniture, consumer electronics devices. I'm sitting here looking at one issue. What issue? Issue 26. It's got toasters in it, t-shirt designs, clothing, new graphic arts for airports, new building designs. It's kind of a pretty wide range, culture, technology, graphics, etc. Again, Monitor Unlimited coming out of London. Next up is Architectural Record. Again, as I mentioned before, I'm originally was an architecture major in college, and I actually designed not my current house, but my house before. So I keep both my feet firmly planted in the architectural space. So I come from a high-tech perspective, so I'm always looking for how does this technology play overall into the into people's lives, and how does that work from a standpoint of actually being used in people's homes, that type of thing. So again, architectural record a must read for me, but may not be on your list. The other is communications arts. I don't read all the issues of communications arts. The one I do tend to read is the issues around interactivity. Again, coming from my job and my perspective, looking at what's happening in an online world. Kind of shifting out of the graphics art space, going into kind of what I would call the culture set of magazines. One that I've just begun starting to read is one called Res Magazine. It really focuses on film, music, art, type of thing, but it's really more about the culture, particularly the younger culture. One of the areas that I do track on my day-to-day job is the gaming space, and so recognizing that I am clearly in the wrong generation. I need some sources of ideas from the standpoint of what's going on in the younger culture, all to my sons and my daughters' horror that I track that space completely. The other is Wired Magazine. That's an obvious read if you're not reading Wired. Now, Wired's gone through its ups and downs. It's been good, and it's not been so good at other times, but. Technology side, MIT Technology Review. Again, it's an absolute must read. This is also one of the RSS feeds that's in my must track RSS feeds. Again, Technology Review, MIT, gives you a good tracking what's going on. Now, here's a magazine. I started reading this was as a kid, and I just have never been able to get rid of it. Many people think of it as kind of being lowbrow. Writing, but Popular Science. It's a great magazine from the standpoint of just the diversity. It's not tied to whether it be gadgets or graphics or architecture or airplanes or whatever the case might be. It covers such a wide range of technologies. And this gets back to a little bit of the looking at other industries and seeing how some kind of a spark of an idea from a completely different industry could potentially be a source or spark for something in your own. So, Popular Science is one of those magazines that is just so diverse, it becomes a source for me. Now, the other is another UK publication called New Scientist. Now, New Scientist is a weekly, and it covers a pretty wide range, but it's a pretty heavy-duty kind of science magazine. But again, because it covers such a wide range and such a diverse set of ideas and technologies and scientific discoveries, that again, it becomes a great source for looking at things completely outside of your normal scope and space, and then using that as your spark of idea. Now, transitioning into normal, or I would say business publications, Fast Company. Fast Company actually has a fairly decent community board that you can participate in. They have a fairly decent innovation board or discussion topics going on in Fast Company. So there's a good one. Business Week, that's an obvious. Fortune and Forbes become are actually regular reads for me. Business 2.0 also. I'm happy to see that Red Herring is coming back. I'm actually be restarting. I was actually a founding subscriber for Red Herring when it originally launched. I was actually still living in Silicon Valley at the time, and was a founding subscriber to the original Red Herring. I'm glad to see it's coming back, and I'm again reading that on a regular basis. And then one that I don't pick up on a regular basis, but it really depends on what's on the front cover, is Harvard Business Review. I'm not a big fan of the heavy writing of publications such as Harvard Business Review, but at the same time, it does cover some topic areas such as innovation, etc., that you can find useful. One of the challenges I just find with Harvard Business Review is making it real. How do you translate that into something that I can actually do with it? And then a fun magazine that I track, and actually I've begun reading it a lot more since I've gotten into podcasting, is Music Tech. Again, it's an overseas publication because I can tell because it's an odd size. It doesn't stack neatly with all my other magazines. But again, it's one that I'm not in the music space. I'm not a musician. But I have found via the podcasting activities a lot of interesting things around about the music industry and music production, etc., that have already translated into some ideas. So again, this is just about half of my monthly read. I'm probably reading somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 or 60 magazines cover to cover on a monthly basis, all to my wife's horror and dismay because I'm also a pack rat and therefore don't get rid of many of them. They are stacked around my office. I guess a fire marshal would actually classify this as a fire hazard. But that just gives you a feel that those will come across as being fairly heterogeneous from the standpoint of not a lot of diversity. One of the other things I do with magazine reading is that I look at magazines that are completely outside of the normal scope that I would read or follow or track. So hopefully that was helpful. And if I come across other interesting publications going forward, then I will go ahead and let you know if I come across something interesting. Okay. We're running a little bit long today, so we're going to move quickly here. Segment three, the killer question of the week. So this week's killer question of the week is who is adapting or disassembling my product to use a key component? Again, who is adapting or disassembling my product to use a key component? Now, in many cases, you may not be aware of what your customers are actually doing with your product or service. How are they disassembling and using key components? It was interesting in the early days of the MP3 players. I'm trying to remember which MP3 player it was, but one of the early ones came out with the first of the mini drives, the little micro drives that are now so popular, for instance, in the iPods. So what the users were doing was is they were buying these MP3 players and literally disassembling them to get the micro drives out of them to use in other applications. If you wanted to buy just a micro drive directly from the manufacturer, they were like a couple hundred dollars. But if you bought the MP3 player, the MP3 player was like $150 and you got the micro drive for it. So quickly, what you found was is people walking into Fry's Electronics, buying 10, 15, 20 of these MP3 players, and then literally destroying them to use one component out of it. And that really was driven by market dynamics. What you also find, though, is that people may buy your product, let's say a piece of software. And we'll use podcasting as an example. In the early days of podcasting, there really wasn't a good set of podcasting software. A set that could do the entire process of recording, editing, creating the RSS feeds, uploading the audio file, posting the RSS feed to the right location, testing that all out, making sure that your show was up and running and available. So what happened was in the early days of podcasting is people went off and acquired six, seven pieces of software. For each piece of software, they may only be using one feature. Now, some of the software companies quickly figured this out and determined about what the users were using their software for, and now you're seeing this rash of, podcast audio software that's being released into the market. So now, rather than you using one or just two features, literally, I wouldn't call it disassembling, but segmenting a product to where you really only wanted one little feature out of it, and you use that as part of a chain of steps in order to deliver a finished product or good at the end. Some of the smarter companies figured that out, that there were users who were adapting or disassembling or using only a small portion of that product in order to achieve something, and now have gone off and created entire sets of podcast software. So, again, this week's killer question is, Who is adapting or disassembling my product or service to use a key component? And with that, thanks for listening. Please keep the feedback coming. Again, you can reach me at podcast@killerinnovations.com or at the feedback line 703-636-4460 or on Skype at Phil_McKinney. And don't forget to visit Podcast Alley and Podcast Pickle to provide feedback on your favorite podcasts. The votes and comments that you put on these sites are really the easiest way for you to say thanks for the time and effort that your producers of the podcast put into researching, recording, editing, posting, and the server costs to support those downloads for your favorite podcast. So it's a pretty simple, low-cost way for you just to cast a vote, spread the word, tell others as a way of saying thanks for the effort that people put into producing your favorite podcast. Also, please join in on the conversation about creativity, innovation, ideas, weak signals. Visit the Killer Innovations website and read the July 16th post of the blog, and there's a link in that that will connect you directly to the beta test site for the Killer Innovations community. And let's participate, let's share ideas, and ask questions, and benefit from the knowledge of the entire listener base. Again, thanks for listening. Sorry for going a few minutes over here today, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.